What is that sound?
Coming from the radio.
It's so interesting and sexy. It requires its own noun. It's ear full of queer. Ear full of queer. 3 to 4 p.m. Mondays on CFRU 93.3.
Hey, you're listening to Ear Full of Queer on CFRU 93.3. In Guelph, and today we have some guests in the studio who are currently on tour doing the Undoing Borders tour, and I'm going to hand it over to them to let them introduce themselves.
Great. Hi, my name is Lee Morales, and I'm here with a couple of other collective members from San Francisco. Do you want to say your name?
My name's Essex O'Lords.
And I'm Molly Goldberg.
We are from a collective in San Francisco called HAVOC, and generally HAVOC stands for the Horizontal Alliance of Very Organized Queers. If you're trying to get a hot date, though, you might say that we are the Hot Alliance of Voraciously or Vengefully or Vaguely Organized Queens. So you can see it's really whatever suits the need. We sometimes are known as the San Francisco chapter of Pride at Work, and Pride at Work nationally in the United States is a organization that represents LGBT union members. And however you know us, you know that we are a volunteer-based collective, and we organize around social and economic justice issues in the queer community in San Francisco.
So we're on tour right now with our zine, the Undoing Borders zine, which we wrote with our collective, with particularly the Migrant Justice Working Group of HAVOC and Pride at Work. And the Migrant Justice Working Group got together in 2007 as a delegation down to the No Borders camp on the U.S.-Mexican border. And we've been working together since then to resist the violence of the border, both in the borderlands and in the interior.
Maybe could you tell us a bit about what you've been writing about in your zine?
Sure. The zine is divided into two parts, and maybe first to give a little context for how the zine came about. We get asked a lot as Pride at Work in general what we're working on has to do with being queer. We do a lot of workplace rights stuff around gentrification, use of public space, immigrant rights work, and over and over and over again, what we hear is those aren't the gay issues, or that's not gay marriage, that's not don't ask, don't tell, that's not whatever the sort of people understand to be the gay struggles to be. In particular, around our presence at the No Borders camp, we were asked, well, why are you sending a queer delegation down to the border? What does queer have to do with borders? And so in an attempt to answer that question, we first look for writing from a whole bunch of other people. And we found some stuff out there that was pretty good, but we wanted to be able to add to the conversation, expand a little bit more on some of these questions. So what we ended up doing was hosting a bunch of queer community gatherings, conversations, where we pulled together people who were working, living, organizing at the intersections of queer and migrant experience and action, and ask people to sort of talk about what these intersections meant to them. What does queer have to do with borders in a whole bunch of different ways? We pulled together a whole bunch of notes. And then about 20 of us over the course of 2 years attempted to try to turn that into something readable.
Yeah. And so like Molly was saying, then the zine ended up sort of all the notes, we sorted them into two types of categories, and one of them was a lot of notes about the ways that we wanted to organize with each other, and many of the notes were about issues that we cared about or wanted to organize, as it turns out, against in many instances, but we'll say a little bit more about that later. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was you've been on tour for like a month now, to talk a bit about some of the places you've stopped and like the things you're excited about.
We've been all over the place. We started in Arizona, in Phoenix, and Tucson, and then moved across the Southwest and then up the eastern seaboard of the United States. Yeah. We were just last in Montreal. So we've been a whole bunch of places, met a lot of really amazing people. I don't know if you all want to talk about some of the projects we've encountered.
Yeah. One of the things in terms of like the zine itself was there's this concept in there of like queer organizing or like fabulosity, this practice of like being with one another, which can also be called community building. And we know it's like not anything new or specific that we're doing, but things that people have done and continue to do, you know, in many different places. So I think for me, that's been one of the exciting things, being on this tour and seeing one, queers are organizing in all sorts of projects and many radical projects everywhere that we've stopped. Specifically, I think, like, in a few cities that we stopped, there had recently been, like, a call for or a need for queers of color in particular and the immigrant people of color to come together and create these community building spaces. I'm thinking of, like, Third Space in Phoenix in Arizona, and also I think it's
BBQ,
which is Black, Brown, and Queer in New Orleans. And there was the Queer People of Color Collective in Greensboro, North Carolina. So it seemed like they all similarly kind of come together in the last year or two or so. And that was really exciting to sort of see these projects, not necessarily linked to one another, but, you know, being on the road, seeing them connected, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting seeing that sort of in different regions, there's really different ways of responding to a lot of these questions, I think. And, you know, when we're in Arizona, an emphasis on people are focused, are looking pretty directly at the U.S.-Mexican border, And when people are talking about systems of incarceration and detention, they're often really intimately linked to the immigration system. And in other places we went, those conversations are looking more at other kinds of policing and criminalization. When we were in Arizona, we did a talk with No More Deaths, which is a humanitarian aid organization based on the U.S.-Mexican border. And they just released a report called The Culture of Cruelty, that looks at systematic abuses by U.S. Border Patrol, and y'all are better at the numbers than me with this.
Yeah, the numbers are, so basically, I guess, between the fall of 2008 and spring 2010, one of the things that No More Deaths does is it, there's these, I guess, I don't know what
there's the resource centers.
Resource centers, they call them, that are right at the border towns on the Mexican side. Mm-hmm. Because when people are deported, what that means is that people get dropped off at these ports of entries and just
thousands of miles from anywhere that anyone's from or familiar with. So a lot, you know, people are being just dropped off in towns in the middle of the night that they don't know. Yeah.
So the resource centers are there to give people sort of like basic food, water, and orientation type stuff. And as well with the volunteers, they've been for that time between fall 2008 and spring 2010, have been collecting sort of these surveys and asking just people about their experiences while in custody with Border Patrol. And so over that time, they interviewed close to 30,000 individuals. And of those individuals, they reported that 99.7% of everyone who was interviewed stated that they had suffered some type of abuse while in custody of Border Patrol, whether it was they were denied access to water or food, or the conditions were extremely cold, or they were separated from their the people that they were traveling with, or whether they were at physically or verbally abused while in custody. And most people actually experience two types of abuses.
At least.
At least, yeah. And Furthermore, there's this whole Border Patrol tries to say that there's this like room for people to file claims against mistreatment because it's not supposed to happen. And of 100 people that were willing to file those claims, zero resulted in any kind of investigation or resolution on behalf of Department of Homeland Security, which is the parent organization for Border Patrol.
So, I think just the point there is that in Arizona, a lot of the focus in a number of ways is around looking at the violence of the physical border and some of the ways that that spreads out into communities there. People are also fighting SB 1070, which is a pretty infamous anti-immigrant bill that was passed in Arizona. People are fighting a recent ban on ethnic studies that was targeted particularly at the high schools in Tucson, Arizona. So a lot of that work there. When we went to other places like New Orleans, Philadelphia, people's focus is a little bit more on the prison system there, the laws that are channeling people into prisons. In Philadelphia, there's a coalition called Decarcerate PA that's looking at fighting the construction of new prisons. In New Orleans, it's the New Orleans Parish Prison. There's a coalition there that's fighting particular stuff at the New Orleans Parish Prison. And also,
did you want to talk about?
About Luna with a Vision.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was another really substantial victory that just happened recently. That's a little bit before we got into New Orleans. The people who were hosting it, some of them were involved with Women with a Vision. And what recently happened was they were successful in repealing the Crimes Against Nature law, which I guess has been in New Orleans for maybe like close to like 300 years is what it actually is. And what that law states is that for anybody found soliciting oral anal sex, one will be charged as a felon for that, as opposed to prostitution, which is a misdemeanor. Also, if you're charged with crimes against nature, that is you get a sex offender, you register as a sex offender. That obviously allows for a lot of discrimination in a lot of different ways as far as access to housing and education and other public services. So Women with a Vision were successful in repealing that law, and it was really important because that law was mainly used to target women of color and trans women, you know, people who the police were perceiving to be doing sex work when for the most part were just walking down the street. And, you know, that really shows, you know, like it brings to the conversation how there's these intersections of violence between identities, and it's like not just, you know, people of color who are being targeted, but it's also this intersection of trans people of color. And we see that through a lot of statistics that have been reported recently that trans people of color actually, one, you know, receive the most amounts of hate violence that's reported, but then also we have recently seen in statistics studies that the majority of hate violence towards gender nonconforming and trans people have been perpetuated by police. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the repealing of that law does a lot for a different number of communities, but it also brings that conversation about how our experiences, you know, are overlapping, mm-hmm. you know, as far as being criminalized and, you know, like how these race-neutral laws are written to specifically target, you know, certain groups of people.
Mm-hmm. And so I think in all of these places, what we're seeing is people are fighting all these variety of ways that, in the example of this crimes against nature legislation, you could be charged either with a misdemeanor solicitation offense, right, or this felony crimes against nature offense. And the leeway that the police have to decide who they charge with what mimics very similarly anti-immigrant bills like SB 1070 or HB 87 in Georgia, which similarly give police a lot of leeway to decide who's going to be targeted, and inevitably that profiling is racist, classist, homophobic, all sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. So all these different places we've gone, we've been really lucky to meet people who are trying to intervene in these sites of criminalization and talk about the ways that, you know, that who's made a criminal is very intimately tied to other systems of social control, mm-hmm. Racialized and other forms of social control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say the other example I think that stands out for me when we're talking right now is in New York we met with Streetwise and Safe, and they are in the process, I think, of working on a campaign to make it so that condoms, even a single condom found in your bag, cannot be submitted as evidence of you being engaged in sex work, because again, it's one of those things where the police decide who they're going to target. Now they're looking in your bag and they find a single condom when you're supposed to be having ideally protected sex, and now it's going to be used against you as evidence when they decide to charge you with solicitation or prostitution. So I felt like that's another example, mm-hmm. too, of people sort of coming around and organizing the ways in which day-to-day activities suddenly become reason for police to target and stop individuals and restrict their movements, right, whether it's through gang injunctions or other types of situations like this.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll take a short break for some music and come back after that.
Thank you.
listening to Earful of Queer on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And we've got a packed studio today. Molly and Lee and Essex are all here from Havoc. And I'm going to ask them about the zine that they're touring with, Undoing Borders, a Queer Manifesto. I'm really curious about the term fabulosity. So I'm going to turn over the mic to you.
So in the first part of our zine, we talk about how we're organizing together. And when we talk about doing queer organizing, we don't talk about queer as a discrete, you know, identity, but rather we talk about queer as the practice, the word that informs how we're organizing together. And, yeah, the word that we use to describe is called fabulosity. And fabulosity means a couple of different things, but to go down the list, at the forefront, fabulosity is, it's our process of intentionally being with each other in ways that are, learning and unlearning are, you know, the experiences that we have in the world of being dominated and being oppressed, like unlearning those systems. It's about finding space to value and incorporate our different experiences into our movements and into our community building, while also just recognizing the different ways that we are rendered problematic and the ways that we're rendered invisible by these systems that, you know, govern our day-to-day lives and tell us where to go and what to do, who to interact with.
Yeah, and I think fabulosity, too, is, it's, for me, like, you know, I keep coming back to the group not because queer encompasses all of who I am, but rather because in the practice of fabulosity, there's, like, there's room for all of us to be, there's a willingness for all of us to be more and more of ourselves, and some of those things can get caught up, you know, can get named in the label, in an identity, and but many of the ways in which we're all complicated really just are not going to get captured that way.
Mm-hmm. So, like, fabulosity is taking the idea of the family unit and looking at that as not something that we're just excluded or included in, but rather looking at that structure and figuring out how we can use that idea to expand who we feel responsible to, rather than, you know, we have these ideas that you're responsible to just your own ethnic group or your own, like, community locally or your own your own blood family, but then taking that concept of family and how that's organized and using that to figure out how we can love each other across these different boundaries and feel responsible for people that we, you know, have been told that we have no, like, reason to be in relation with. You know, fabulosity also means asking for what we want as opposed to what we think we can get, and that looks like asking for what we want of each other and our interpersonal relationships. So, you know, asking how we want to be seen, what our preferred gender pronouns are, but also it asks, you know, for what we want and how we want to be seen and recognized and treated when we're organizing, when we're speaking to whatever, you know, systems that, you know, aren't providing for us, or, you know, state structures that are enacting violence upon us, you know, asking for what we want, you know, concretely.
Yeah, and so, and concretely what this looks like in the group is that we shifted from being a more, I guess, traditional, hierarchical, you know, co-chair model to a group that does all of our decisions by consensus. And it also looks like trying to make meetings enjoyable, not just you come in with the long agenda, but also maybe we come in and check in with each other and bring some food, and also finding ways to make space for all the different types of work that we all can bring to the table, or just offerings. Not everyone can tolerate being in the meeting, so it's finding ways to get things done outside of meeting spaces, and also just being in each other's lives, like dancing together, you know, eating together, going on road trips together, just like we're doing now.
Yeah, keep going. Like, you know, well, fabulosity, you know, it sounds great, but fabulosity isn't always so fabulous because, you know, we are bringing all these different experiences to the table. We have a lot of moments where we have conflict or we just flat out disagree with each other, and this the decision-making process that we're trying to, you know, engage in, but we share that because, you know, that is part and parcel of this process of, you know, learning and unlearning and creating different ways of being in community with each other and valuing each other and just figuring out how to make space for all these different, you know, contributions that we have.
Mm-hmm. And knowing we don't always get it right, but that the process of both trying to do it and trying to do it publicly is important, and that we're trying to make the road by walking, and it can be messy.
It is messy.
It's often messy. But in a good way.
So I think that's like that's probably the first part of the zine that's queer, you know, organizing and fabulosity is the how.
During the break, somebody, one of the silent masses in this room, asked a question about sort of specifically what else is in the zine. Do you want us to talk a bit about that? Yeah. Okay. So after the fabulosity part, there's a section of the zine called Points of Unity. And for people who are listening who are interested in reading the zine, it's available online at undoingborders.wordpress.com. There's a PDF for printing and a PDF for reading on the screen that people can download. But so the Points of Unity section is divided into four sections that focus on some different aspects of how we think queerness and borders are related to one another. The first is titled Freedom of Movement. And it talks about how that means more than just the right to cross national boundaries. It's about every person's ability to work or live or exist where they choose without economic, social, or state coercion. So it's equal parts enabling people to stay where they choose as it is dismantling walls and prisons and laws that keep us apart, whether that's free trade policies like NAFTA or militarized border or laws that criminalize mutual aid.
The second section there is titled Resisting Militarization and Criminalization. And there we wanted to draw connections between a more and more militarized approach to the border and its enforcement, and especially in the U.S. The border is very militarized at the U.S.-Mexico border, and the ways policing is increasingly offered as a ways to make us feel safer in the interior. And oftentimes we know that what the state identifies as threats are actually acts of individual resistance and survival. And sometimes these are described as threats to national security and the social order, for example, undocumented border crossing or sex work, loitering, or having important relationships that are unrecognized by the state or social norms. And the fact that these activities are defined as criminal and the notion that people doing these activities need to be policed is deeply rooted in legacies of colonialism and empire.
And the third section is called Work in Borders. And here we are seeking to root out the racism and homophobia in the labor movement and think about how we can break down the structures that exist to divide us as workers. We want to dismantle the tools of an economic system meant to separate us from one another. You know, those tools might be international free trade agreements like NAFTA or CAFTA, or they might be local efforts to criminalize or police us like workplace raids or anti-organizing laws. We also want to stress that work can look like a lot of things, paid or unpaid. You know, and we are particularly opposed to the criminalization of our survival strategies. You know, like the last section talked about. So lots of ways we make money are illegal, from sex work to working or selling under the table, or in unregulated markets, to crossing borders, or to find work somewhere else. But for the most part, we're all trying to get by and care for our loved ones. We believe part of queering how we think about work is about expanding what we think about as valuable work and in the first place, as well as creating more less oppressive ways for us to take care of ourselves and to take care of one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's just one more section. It's titled Policing Ourselves. And in this section, we speak to the connection between the policing of our genders and sexualities and the policing of borders. Through documentation, the government holds the power to legitimize our genders, our relationships, or our presence in the country. And this power of the government to legitimize some while criminalizing others creates conditions for really coercive social norms to seem natural, right? So like traditional families, what's an acceptable sex practice, citizenship, all of these social norms in turn can make it appealing for us and all of our social movements to appeal to a higher authority like state power, and makes it seem like an effective strategy, right, to gain rights or access. But part of what we're asking in this section is access or right to what, right? So rather than fighting for marriage equality, for example, we're seeking to create free and inclusive communities where we don't place legal borders between coupled families and those who enjoy single or asexual or polyamorous lifestyles, to lift up all the different kinds of relationships of care and interdependence that we share. And freedom of movement or access to services and other benefits should be available to all of us, regardless of our marital or immigration status, right? So we seek to build a world where everyone can assert their self-determination, whatever that is, and where government control over access to documentation no longer impacts our abilities to lead the lives we want to live. So those are the four main sections. Do you want to talk about sort of our reflections on that?
Yeah, and I also kind of feel like just mentioning that I guess maybe these concepts are, you know, available online and in the zine, and also some of the things that we've shared are sort of how we've put this into practice in our organizing.
On this tour, when
we talk about it, we usually share some organizing that we did very early on in terms of collaborating with other groups in the city to win a municipal ID that didn't list your gender and did not require for you to have federal documentation for you to have access to this document.
Right.
We've also talked about other coalition organizing against an ordinance in San Francisco that passed last year, SITLI, which would make it illegal for people. It is now illegal for people to sit or lie on the sidewalks between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m.
Business hours,
giving the police discretion on who they're going to decide needs to move it from the sidewalk. We also talked about being part of the San Francisco Immigrant Rights Defense Coalition and working there most recently to opt out of secure communities, which is perhaps for people in Canada who don't know, secure communities is a federal fingerprint sharing program.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what it mandates is that local law enforcement takes everybody's fingerprints and runs it through a national database. And if the database turns your fingerprints as a match for someone who is or has a history of being unlawfully in the country, a hold is then sent from immigration officials to local police requesting that you are held so that then immigration can show up to the jails and you can go through a deportation.
And this might feel a little irrelevant to people in Canada, except for that we just got an email today, actually, from somebody that we met in Montreal who mm-hmm. said that it turns out that there are some cases being brought up where actually the Canadian immigration authorities are collaborating with the U.S. immigration authorities to access this database. And I think
it was two Tamil fighters mm-hmm. that were, detained based on having their fingerprints show up as having been
part of the
Sri Lankan Liberation Army. Is that right?
Tamil Tigers,
yeah. And so, we're seeing this collaboration not just within the United States, but also beyond. I guess I was going to get into one of the critiques that we had of our zine ourselves, because if you look at that section, it's all about being against this and we oppose that and we don't like this and we resist the other. And so it was just like, okay, well, what are we for, everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. And as we sat a little bit longer with our own reflection, it just became clear that what we were resisting and opposing are the many ways in which our day-to-day lives and the lives of people that we care about are being turned into individual acts of illegality that require the policing and the fining and the incarceration to control. And so part of being on this tour, too, I think it's helped us sort of surface this idea of criminalization as the thing that people in power are sort of using to try to control us in many different ways, us being a multiplicity of different people that aren't benefiting the capitalist order of, you know, work and productivity.
Yeah, I think as we're able to sort of pull out this, realizing this theme of all these things we're resisting are actually wanting to have more room to be able to develop our own sort of autonomous ways of relating to one another, of building community, you know, recognizing the importance of all sorts of survival strategies and strategies to live more full lives. That it also for us draws out a need in all of our movements to figure out how to talk about the work that we're doing in ways that don't throw some other people under the bus, right? And so for us, that looks like a number of things. It means that as we're doing work in these various coalitions that we're part of, thinking about how to shift some of the narratives that we hear a lot, things like "Don't deport us, we're not criminals. Don't deport us, we're good family members. Don't deport us, we're hard workers," right? And I think the question that's brought up when we hear messaging like that is, well, who are the criminals that do deserve to be deported? Who are the bad family members, right? Who are the people whose families are not recognizable, or who aren't justified to be here, who do deserve to be deported or locked up in jail or whatever it is, right? And similarly, I think the mainstream LGBT rights movement relies on pretty similar rhetoric around, you know, our love is just like your love, so don't be afraid of us, right? Let us get married, whatever it is. And I think, again, there's this implied other whose freak love is something you should be afraid of, right? And again, I think the question is, how do we do this work in ways that doesn't name the other that does need to be controlled, that we should be afraid of, that we should deport, that we should lock in prison? And that for us, I think, has become a pretty important theme in this work and as we're on this tour.
Well, we're starting to run a bit short on time, so I'm going to throw on another Ostra track. If folks are interested in continuing this discussion, you should come to the potluck this evening at 42 Oliver Street, 6 p.m. And then I'm going to turn it over to Essex to DJ.
Okay, and we're back. So we're going to end today's conversation with a little bit of music. I am also a DJ. My DJ name is DJ Booty Clap. And just to close it out, I thought I'd just play a new genre of music that I really like to spin. It's called Moombatone. And I'll cut the whole story of how that genre came about short. And just like briefly, the genre, it's pretty much taking the genre of Dutch house, which is usually like a faster, like 125 to 130 BPM, and turning it to 108 and combining it with like sounds of reggaeton and cumbia, which gives it a more like Latin base. And it's been blowing up a lot over the past couple of years. So I thought I'd just take the time to kind of like give it a little exposure on the radio. So I'm going to play a couple of original Mumbatón tracks as well as some Mumbatón remixes to just like highlight the genre.
Some boy them a hype and a bright and a go like them bad and lose them life. Them this them dead same time. Gun back shot jack boy get flat line.
Attention, please. From a girl, 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 girl.